hello and welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3 and it's Saturday morning. It's time for books. It's Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel. I have been having a little bit of a break, lots of reading in anticipation of the Sydney Writers' Festival just around the corner, and exciting stuff has been happening while I've been gone. Now, it is the last Saturday of the month. That means it is time for Australian Classics Book Club. We will be talking about Amy Whiting's Eye for Isabel. I'll be joined by David Winter from Text Publishing, as well as author Ashley Hay. We're going to be talking about Amy Whiting and her fantastic book, Eye for Isabel. I encourage you to stick around for that. While I was away, there was also this little thing called the Stella Prize. Maybe you've heard of it. Heather Rose was announced as the winner for her work, The Museum of Modern Love. And Heather will be joining me on the show. We're going to discuss her win, discuss her absolutely fantastic novel. I read it over the last week and I absolutely fell in love. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. I've got so much to fit in. We'll be back after this short message.
Luminous, furious, and wildly inventive, Colson Whitehead's 2017 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Underground Railroad, has been lauded by Barack Obama and Oprah Winfrey. Join Colson at Sydney Writers' Festival as he sits down with New York Times book review editor Pamela Paul to discuss his imaginative exploration of the foundational sins of America. May 27, City Recital Hall. Tickets on sale at swf.org.au. Sydney Writers' Festival, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
Good morning. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, and I am Andrew Popel. And right now, I'm joined on the line by Heather Rose. Heather is the author of White Heart, The Butterfly Man and The River Wife, as well as the Tuesday McGillicuddy series for children with fellow author Danielle Wood. But she's joining me today because we are celebrating her win in the 2017 Stella Prize. Last week, the Stella Prize was announced. Congratulations, Heather.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
And you won for The Museum of Modern Love, just an absolutely magnificent book. I've had just the most fun the last week reading it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Now, the Stella Prize, it's in its fifth year. We love the Stella Prize on Final Draft. It's probably one of the most exciting times of the year. And more than just a single prize, it's now expanded. You've got the Stella Count, the Stella Schools Program, Girls Ride Up, Stella Sparks. It's a ubiquitous feature on our literary calendar. What was it like for you? You know, this has now been a three-ish month process from the long list to the short list and then winning.
It is a long process, but the Stella team are so impeccable at supporting us through all those phases of the prize. And to see the way they celebrate literature, they celebrate women's writing, they celebrate girls and creativity and the writing that's happening in schools, as you've mentioned, it really is a spectacular organisation to be associated with. And the prize itself, of course, it's already had four remarkable winners. And to have the Museum of Modern Love acknowledged in that way was utterly extraordinary, Andrew. And I remain deeply, deeply thrilled, and I think I'll be happy for at least a year.
Probably, I would say much, much longer. You've joined what I think will become a pantheon of Australian writing. We will be talking about the Stella winners for a long time. Now, in your Stella acceptance speech, you discussed our societal difficulty with accepting and celebrating successful and powerful women. This theme emerges also in the Museum of Modern Love, with people's questioning of Marina Abramovich's work. We'll probably talk a little bit more about that later. Despite the fact it was having this overwhelming success, we've got Archie's difficulty, his blindness even, to exactly how much his wife Lydia does. So whilst prizes like the Stella, they surely signal a move in the right direction, are we in any way on a path towards acknowledging women and celebrating, even rewarding them properly?
I think our domestic violence, which I would like to reframe as male violence largely, its statistics are so horrifying. I think we're still quite a long way from celebrating women and acknowledge the extraordinary contribution, the powerful contribution women make in Australian culture from every level of life. And I think that until we start to see massive drops in male violence, domestic violence towards women, we haven't even begun.
I'm speaking with Heather Rose. Heather has won the 2017 Stella Prize for the Museum of Modern Love. The book takes as its centre performance artist Marina Abramovich's 2010 work, The Artist is Present. The show saw visitors to New York's Museum of Modern Art invited to sit opposite Abramovich in silence. It was an extraordinary success, and from that we have your wonderful book. Of the hundreds of thousands of potential lives that came and went from The Artist is Present in its 75 days, what drew you to the lives that you've depicted? And I'll clarify that these are fictional lives, but Jane, Aki, Helias, Bratika, what drew you to these lives?
Characters just arrived for me, quite honestly, Andrew. And Aki came, I could see him at the piano as we see him in the first scene. And I thought, oh, wow, he's a composer, he's a film composer. But I had no understanding of what that meant. So I did an enormous amount of research to create his character. His emotional arc was very difficult because, as we know, Aki has a hard time connecting with the people in his life. But what was lovely is when he met the character Jane, who was inspired by someone I met during The Artist is Present, I must say. She was a teacher. She didn't have the background that Jane does. I never got to know her that well, but she'd come to New York and she said to me that lovely thing of, gosh, I was going to go and see the Statue of Liberty. I was going to go see the Empire State, and all I can do is come back to this art event. So I drew a character out of that initial conversation, and I loved exploring Jane and her deep emotional resonance with her students, with her husband, who of course has passed away. And so to have these two people where she can see him and he can't see her was really quite a lot of fun. And knowing that they were not going to have a relationship, knowing that this was one of those confluences that our overarching character in Muse talks about at the beginning of the novel, the rest of them just stepped in. One day, Helias just walked across the square and I realised that Aki knew her and that she was in his band. So they unfolded. They all unfolded. And Bratika too. There were many, many young students from around the world who were coming to that show and who were busy on their laptops doing PhDs or masters in all sorts of fields of art and drama. So there was a beautiful presence of young people at The Artist is Present, so I wanted to have a younger character. And then the ghost of Danica, she came really early into the book. She was there almost from the start, and she had that very feisty personality. And I love having a ghost in the book. I think that's fun.
More than anything, I found my pleasure in reading The Museum of Modern Love was indulging in that contemplation of what makes art. And we see Aki doing it with his composition, Bratika with her PhD, where she questions her own, I guess, artistic self, because she's involved so much of her life with Marina. Just what art is and what it is to make a life. The Artist is Present evoked mixed reactions around its function and its nature as in scare quotes, art. Some great comments. I don't know if these were things you overheard, but things like, is it a staring contest? People were saying in the crowd. We can also see that kind of controversy. It's brewing again around Mona's Dark Mofo exhibition and the work 150 Action from Hermann Nitsch. Is this a conversation, though, you know, the what is art? Is this art? Is it a conversation that ever needs settling? Or does art by its very nature require that we are continually just discussing it?
I think it's so beautiful if we continually discuss it, because creativity is the wellspring of our humanity. We are creative beings, and so the idea that we suppress that in any way, I think, is quite tragic, and it gets suppressed in this country through very, very limited resources for our festivals and events, very limited resources, if any, for individual artists. And yet that is the richness that brings us together as humans. And I always think the energy of a festival is so special, that we come together to celebrate music or art or whatever it is that's bringing us together. And people are enriched by it in ways they don't anticipate. So I think that while ever we keep discussing art, while ever we keep celebrating art, while ever we keep questioning what it is that brings out our creativity, isn't it great that they're all debating what is art?
I am speaking with Heather Rose. Heather has won the 2017 Stella Prize for the Museum of Modern Love. It is a hotly anticipated event on the literary calendar, and I'm so pleased to be speaking with you, Heather. Thank you so much for taking the time to share this with us.
Oh, thank you, Andrew. It was a delight.
You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. We're going to take a track now before coming back with the Australian Classics Book Club for April. This is Dorsal Fins with Romeo. In Trump's inaugural address, he promised to save America from crime and disorder.
This American carnage stops right here, right now.
Data editor of The Guardian US, Mona Chalabi, editor-in-chief of Slate, Julia Turner, lauded writer George Saunders, and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Colson Whitehead discussed Trump's progress at Sydney Writers' Festival, May 26, Sydney Town Hall. Tickets on sale at swf.org.au. Sydney Writers' Festival, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
Racists and bigots and fascists? Oh my. For now, Section 18C remains unchanged. That's the part of our Racial Discrimination Act that makes it illegal to offend, insult, humiliate, or intimidate someone because of their race. It's the little clause that could, but for how long? 2SER's first ever podcast series, Just Words, where we looked at the Racial Discrimination Act, is wrapped for now. And you can catch all six episodes and podcast extras anytime you like. Just head to iTunes or your favourite podcast app and download them all, or go to the 2SER website, 2SER.com.
Good morning. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, and I am Andrew Popel. Now, it's the last Saturday of the month, and that means it is time to discover or rediscover another Australian classic. It is the Australian Classics Book Club, our monthly search, discovery, adventure into Australian writing throughout the years. Now, I'm joined by my regular book club colleague, David Winter. He's a senior editor at Text Publishing, who are the publishers of the amazing Text Classics, where we are sourcing our book club. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Andrew.
And today we're also joined. We've got a triumvirate book club. I'm joined by Ashley Hay. She's the author of the internationally acclaimed books such as The Body in the Clouds, The Railwayman's Wife. And Ashley has written the introduction to Amy Whiting's A Change in the Lighting. I've sort of given away what we're talking about, but first I'm going to welcome you, Ashley.
Hi, Andrew.
Now, I gave away, you wrote the introduction to Amy Whiting's A Change in the Lighting. We're not talking about a change in the lighting. That is a text classic that's just arrived this March. We are talking about Amy Whiting's Eye for Isabel. And this was my first reading of Eye for Isabel. I'm really excited to be chatting about it. It is the story of a young girl, and we travel with her as she grows into adulthood. But let's get to know Amy Whiting, the author, a little bit better. David, can you tell us a little bit about who Amy Whiting is?
Sure. Well, she was born in 1918, and she was quite a brilliant student and ended up at Sydney Uni at a very fertile period there, when there was James Macaulay and Douglas Stewart, who went on to perpetrate the Erne Malley hoax. And they were the brilliant figures on campus, and Amy Whiting was perhaps slightly more retiring. She went into teaching, first in rural New South Wales and then at North Sydney Girls High, which is quite an eminent school. And she was, by all accounts, a really sensational teacher of English and French. She didn't really start writing seriously until the 1950s. By the 1960s, she had two stories published in The New Yorker, which I think might still be as many as any Australian writer has had in that publication. And there's then quite another lag until her first novel, The Visit, is published in 1977. So at that point, she's almost 60. This is where things get really strange. Like, she finishes Eye for Isabel very quickly, which is a superior novel to The Visit. The Visit is very good, but Eye for Isabel is a masterpiece. And she can't get the book published. Her agent, Margaret Connolly, tells me that she sent the manuscript to every publisher in the country. The responses were pretty strange, sometimes pretty vicious, really, to the novel, and we can probably get into that when we talk more about its themes. But that decade really stalled Amy Whiting's already late-starting career. When the book was published in 1989, it became a bestseller, and Ashley's already alluded to the kind of feeling around the book and the splash that it made. The floodgates really opened for Amy Whiting at that point. She, in the next decade of her life, so between 70 and 80-something when she died, she produced four novels, many, many poems, a lot of very good short stories. So she's incredibly prolific in late life. I don't know of anyone else who had such an amazing burst. And now until recently when we republished her, she seemed already to have slipped back in the literary consciousness to some extent.
We are here to redress that. We are going to storm the literary barricades and restore Amy Whiting to the parapet as we discuss Eye for Isabel. It really is a wonderful tale. I confess that this is my first reading of it, and I was really struck. Just in brief, we have the story of a young girl, Isabel, and we meet her with a very cold, emotionally abusive mother, and we follow her as she grows into adulthood. And that's probably both a very brief synopsis, but also covers what Eye for Isabel has. And it's really in the psychology of Isabel and how she goes about her world and discovering her world that we get the real content and enjoyment from the book.
I think you've mentioned something really important, which is the sort of the dominance of her mother. Her mother is this just awful, awful woman. I'm all for trying to see everybody's side of the story, but my goodness, I would love to have known what caused Isabel's mother to treat her the way she did. And not only does she really just confine and delineate and hamper Isabel's life, but she sort of dominates our sense of the book as well. We were talking before we began this conversation of the way your sense of the book before you read it is that it is all about Isabel and her mother, and that is certainly the starting point, and is certainly, you know, as Isabel grows up, there is so much there that she has to work out. But the mother is this incredibly well-made character. She is she is an extraordinary piece of work, literally and sort of metaphorically. In Charlotte Wood's introduction to the text classic, there's a quote from the very prominent Australian editor Beatrice Davis, where she says something like, you know, it's too dark, or nobody could possibly have a mother as dreadful as this. And that's amazing to me, that Amy Whiting's creation of this woman was so good, it was sort of the thing that blocked the novel from having its own life in a way.
Mm. I think it's really interesting that the how we approach the novel. I really we've talked about how Isabel's mother can almost overshadow the text, but for me, she became this antithesis against which Isabel was going to fight. So in very early on in the book, Isabel became this heroic figure for me, and particularly in her joy and love of books. And I thought, for me, if I as I was preparing to speak with you both, I thought that's what I really want to talk about, because Isabel is this character that is like so many of us, I presume very much like both of you, and so many people I know who just loves books and finds so much from them, including refuge from a person like her mother.
Yes, and I think one of the things that I found so wonderfully honest in I for Isabel is Amy Whiting's portrayal of how people who are not as enamored of the world of books can find that kind of passion or that kind of obsession so completely not just alien, but they can react to it in a very hostile way.
It's such a real thing too. I was reading this book, I think it was last weekend, I was sitting in a pub just reading the book by myself, and it was a Friday or a Saturday and there was football on, and I got to the part where Isabel's in the boarding house trying to read and she's getting things thrown at her, and I really felt, I could feel that isolation, because you sit alone in a pub with a book, and even if nothing's thrown at you, the looks are thrown.
Yeah, and it's a really ongoing theme in Whiting's work, which could be tedious in the hands of a lesser writer, but it just seems it's always so natural and intrinsic to what she does, that there are these really quite subtle critiques of small-minded anti-intellectualism. There's this great short story that about a young woman who has to take a room in a small boarding house, and you know, is prepared to pay an exorbitant rental fee because she's going to have a room of her own to plonk down the typewriter and start her work as a writer, and then swiftly discovers that the landlady can't abide this. First the desk is full of stuff, and then the typewriter is making a hideous noise, and what is this racket? And people who write, people who read, are treated with hostility, with suspicion, and of course sometimes with sort of, you know, mild physical violence. So it's always entertaining, and that thread is always running through her work.
I also found something that might have been obscured at the beginning, but how highly gendered the novel is. At the beginning, we very much have Isabel, her sister, her mother, all of these female characters. So we have this sort of playing field where the male characters seem on the periphery, but then adult Isabel, she discovers this group of poets in a Glebe cafe, and apart from the fact I absolutely loved that, because I am 5 minutes, 10 minutes maximum walk right now from where this happened. I might have to go for a walk just to live in Isabel's world after our conversation. But she finds this new world opening up to her, but despite the modest encouragement that she receives from Trevor, one of the group, it's the men of the group who write and recite, and it's hard to imagine them having faced the struggles that Isabel has overcome just to carve her place in the world. And I was really interested in that sort of gendered reading of the novel and Isabel's struggle against her mother, definitely, but also the fact that she is a woman in a world that isn't really listening to female voices at the time.
Yeah, I think there's a comment that Whiting herself made at one point, that she was always trying to escape the Macaulay crowd, and that, you know, they were so sort of dominating, and it's tempting to kind of see that in this scene, even though, you know, we shouldn't mistake Isabel for Whiting, that she doesn't have the same privilege as those student poets, and so she's really desiring to be part of their world.
There are kind of layers of hierarchy amongst the people in that group of poets that she sort of walks up to and gets herself into in Glebe, and I found her act of, you know, she hears these people talking in a cafe about poetry. Someone is reciting their poetry and, you know, someone else is kind of giving an immediate critique of it. And she, there's this magnetism that pulls herself that pulls her across the cafe, and she thinks that she recognizes one of the girls, and she sits there, drags the girl's name out of her head. You know, they've been at school together, and this extraordinary act of bravery where she walks over and, you know, introduces herself and gets herself in there. But as she is entering the group, and as you sort of meet the group through her, those layers of hierarchy still exist within the group. So there are the poets who are, you know, sort of acknowledged by everyone in the group to be the brilliant ones. And then there are the other male members of the group who are already kind of deferring to those brilliant people and saying, oh, well, you know, I'm not really interested in being a writer. You know, they've already, those people have claimed their space. Then there's the next spot down. Then there's there are the other women in the group. And there's a great scene. I can't remember if it's the first or second conversation she has with these people. Isabel tells a story from her boarding house, from two of the older women at her boarding house. And it's this wonderful, wonderful anecdote. And the group start discussing it. And someone says, you know, do you think Isabel made it up? And it's another woman who says, I hope she didn't. It's that, just that sort of, another woman doesn't want this unknown entity to have had this brilliant imaginative flash that would have created this thing. So even in the, you know, beyond the sort of gendered split in a way, there are all these other layers, and Isabel is having to navigate herself as a very sort of single and isolated creature.
I thought, interestingly, the one time that she is actually called on to use her words, to use her voice, is actually, strangely enough, when you've got at your hands all of these brilliant wordsmiths, the one that you think would defer to them. But when Nick dies and someone has to go and tell Diana, she's called on for this strangely sort of macabre duty. And it's really just because nobody else wants to do it. Her voice is almost the voice of last resort here.
Oh, it's just one of the most extraordinary pieces of writing in the book. It allows Amy Whiting to write this amazing, amazingly human scene of grief and shock and I don't know, sort of a really kind of strangely rageful release, which is just one of the most compelling pieces of life I have ever seen set down on the page. It is an extreme event, you know, like the extreme events that we need to put into narratives and those sorts of things. But yeah, it was one of the scenes that just absolutely rang with power in terms of what Whiting could get Isabel and the other character Diana to do, and how she could allow Isabel to observe.
I completely agree, and I think it is a perfect example of how Whiting's characters do things that are very real and human, but then they don't always react in the way that people in books do. I mean, there's a real drive against cliche, I think, in Whiting's writing. Mm.
You are tuned in to the Australian Classics Book Club, and we are discussing Eye for Isabel from Amy Whiting. I'm going to say thank you to my guest, my regular book club colleague, David Winter. Thank you so much for joining me again, David.
Thanks, Andrew. It was great.
And we were also joined this month by Ashley Hay. She has written the introduction to Amy Whiting's A Change in the Lighting. If you have read along with us Eye for Isabel, you can go out and check out A Change in the Lighting. Ashley is also the author of The Body in the Clouds, The Railwayman's Wife, amongst many others. Thank you so much for joining us, Ashley.
Thanks, Andrew.
And you are tuned into 2SER 107.3, where you're listening to Final Draft, books, writing and literary culture. That was the Australian Classics Book Club. If you want to join in and read along for next month, David and I will be approaching The Watchtower by Elizabeth Harrower. So go get yourself a copy and join in the conversation. I want to say a big thanks to David and also to Ashley Hay, who joined me in the book club this week. Also to Heather Rose. Thank you and congratulations. Heather was the winner of this year's Stella Prize, the 2016 Stella Prize, for her novel, The Museum of Modern Love. That's it for another week. I'm going to say bye. I will be back with more books. The Sydney Writers Festival is coming up, so there is going to be so much amazing content. Do tune in on Tuesdays and catch the book club with Nick Healy and I. And don't go anywhere. The Vulture's Nest is coming up next, just a few seconds away, with a fantastic take on the week's news and events. My name is Andrew Popel. I'll see you next week for more Final Draft. Bye now.
My mind has just been blown.